Okay, this lecture is on value, utility, and price, and we might begin with some of the basic principles and see how first a value is derived logically from these basic principles about human action. So human action we know is purposeful behavior, that is, it's behavior that's directed toward the attainment of an end. The attainment of the end is the motive that we have for engaging in the action. Obviously, having an end doesn't constitute action, though. In order to act, we must identify and come to possess the means that are available in the world and use them in order to attain the end. So we see that human action is always in the ends-means framework. We begin thinking about human action with the fundamental axiom of economics, that human action exists. This statement is axiomatic because any attempt to demonstrate that human action does not exist is a human action. It has as its end, attempting to prove this proposition false and employs certain means, lecturing, writing a paper, sitting and doing nothing, whatever the person might envision would be a demonstration of such a thing. But, of course, we know more than just the mere fact that human action exists as we begin to think about economics. And this knowledge, as Rothbard points out, comes to us reflectively. That is, we can just sit and think about what it means to engage in human action. We can think about our own actions in the past. We can begin to think theoretically about action in terms of its categorical structure, not just about ends and means, but about other elements of action, and Dr. Salerno has already spoken about some of these things, so you've been introduced to this. But as human beings, since we are human actors, we're capable of setting out a categorical structure of action from the very beginning. And valuation, of course, is part of that initial structure. Now, as we begin this process of deduction, let's start with this proposition, again, one that we arrive at through our own reflective thought about acting, and that is that only individuals act. So human action requires a human person, and the human person is the agent of acting. Now, of course, what this proposition is meant to exclude is the possibility of collective acting, of a collective entity that engages in action, or the notion, speaking about value, of collective value. So there can be no such thing in economic reasoning as collective value. Now notice this sets up a theoretical problem that economics must grapple with, and the Austrian economist has solved this problem, which is how do you reconcile in the social situation the differing valuations that individuals make? Or to put the case in a slightly different way, if we recognize as human beings the greater productivity of a division of labor and wish to engage in a division of labor as a productive system, how then do we know what is more valuable to some people and less valuable to others? If we're just making production decisions and saying, oh, let's produce iPods and not tape decks, well, then we have to have a way of making comparisons of value between different people's assessment of what is valuable and what is not. And it's this particular question of how we make these comparisons of value that is one of the, again, fundamental problems of microeconomics. And we'll see that this problem of comparing value cannot be solved by the process of, as we call it, evaluation itself. It requires something more than this, what Mises calls appraisement. And so we want to see the connection between these two concepts. Now, moving on, let's just point out, of course, that in action, means are scarce. Action always implies unmet ends, and unmet ends imply that we have a lack of means. So if we could imagine a situation where all means were abundant to us, of course, that would imply no action at all. We'd be engaged in activity, but no action. So a post-scarcity world is impossible. We won't think any more about the implications of it, but you could think through the various difficulties involved in something like this. This is not to say, of course, that in action we're not paying attention to the degree of scarcity of things. The degree of scarcity of things could change, but the fact of scarcity persists. Now, if means are scarce and yet human action exists, it of course follows that we must allocate our means in action. So if we have more ends than we can imagine attaining and only a limited number of means by which we can attain these ends, then every time we act, we must have chosen to pursue certain ends and forego other ends. So all action involves choice or allocation. This allocation, of course, to be consistent with action, must be according to the way we value things. So we choose according to the ends that we hold to be valuable, pursuing those things we find more valuable and setting aside those things that we find less. And so we get this idea from the comparison of the value of different ends that we might pursue. We get this idea of preference. So this is the, if you will, a basic notion of value in the Austrian view. Preference, then, is simply the rank order of the different valuations that a person considers to be options in action. So we say that one thing is more valuable, another thing is less valuable. This is an ordinal rank, right? We're just saying better or worse, preferred and not preferred. Additionally, as Rothbard points out, preference is part of action. So preference exists as we act. It's bound up in the action itself. It isn't as if a preference is a separate existing thing from the action. This is the way in which utility or value is treated by mainstream economists. We have utility, it's sort of like a utility map or utility function that exists somehow separate and apart, somehow is self-existing. And then action sort of conforms to it. This isn't the way in which we find value when we think about it. From the Austrian perspective, preference simply is in our action. So we're deciding to act, we're valuing, choosing one course of action and setting aside another. Preference then, of course, as Rothbard put it, is demonstrated in action. Our preference is always a demonstrated preference. When we see a person engaged in an action, then we know what their preferences were at that moment. Aside from that, we know nothing about their preferences. Now, there are two further points we want to make about value that are stressed in the Austrian view and that we see are logically derivable from this system that we've started discussing. One is the subjectivity of value, that value is subjective. And by subjective, we mean that value is an intensive state of mind. Value exists in our mind and therefore has no extensive property. If it has no extensive property, then it cannot be measured. We can't define a unit of it. There isn't any way to assess its objective properties by, comparing them on some objective standard, like an inch, and we measure the distance of something, or a pound, and we measure the weight of something. So it isn't possible to define a unit of value. This is what subjectivity implies. So there can be no cardinal numbers that would be applied to value. There aren't any cardinal numbers that can be applied to value. If there's no objective way of defining a unit of value that's common among different individuals, then there isn't any way of comparing value interpersonally. And so we can't say that, I value a chocolate ice cream cone at 10 utils and you value a vanilla ice cream cone at 8 utils. And so my value is 2 utils greater than yours. That sort of thing is precluded by the nature of value. Value is a state of mind, not a substance that would be subject. It's not an objective substance that would be subject to a measurement, subject to the application of arithmetic operations and so on. Now, separate and apart from the subjectivity of value is the non-constancy of value. Value is not constant. That is to say, there are no quantitatively constant relationships between external circumstances that influence our action and the action itself. All the external circumstances that influence our action, the way in which they influence our action are by a judgment of our mind. Everything is filtered through our mind, right? The price of the good, the amount of income we have, its objective qualities in serving our end and so on. The way in which all of those objective features of reality affect our action is through our mind. Only when our mind says, I value this objective property, the good, at such and such, or I value the monetary price at such and such a level, does the effect come through in action? By the way, we know this immediately by the recognition of the concept of regret. We know immediately, in other words, because we've regretted taking actions in the past, that it must have been possible for us with similar external circumstances to have chosen differently and acted in a different way. And therefore, we see that there isn't anything like a fixed connection, quantitatively fixed connection, between external circumstances and action itself. Now, this, of course, implies that there can be no such thing as a mathematical treatment of utility. If there are no constants, there are no functions could be applied to utility. Nor is it possible, of course, to have something like quantitative mathematical expressions of demand where there are units, right? Where subjectivity isn't a problem, right? We do have units of price, units of money, units of the good, and so we have the subjectivity problem is not stopping us from formulating quantitative relationships here. What stops us is the non-constancy, that if demand comes from our utility or our value, and our value is not constant, there's no quantitatively definite connections between external circumstances and the way we act, the results of our action, then again, there can be no mathematical functions, even though there are cardinal numbers to play around with, prices and quantities that we can relate, right, empirically. Now, on Wednesday, in the lecture on further applications and issues in valuation, we'll talk about this in more detail. We'll talk about how mainstream economists attempt to get around this lack of a mathematical treatment of utility and demand and so on. To continue on, we can see because of choice, we can see that cost must also be subjective in value in action. It must just be the value of the alternative that we do not choose. And also, as Rothbard points out, this implies that profit is fundamentally subjective. In every action, we aim at what we consider to be a subjective or psychic profit, foregoing a lesser valued option to pursue an option of greater value. This is not a bourgeois notion that is used to exploit the working class or something. This is a fundamental notion of all acting. Now, Mises was fond of saying that the sort of, if we could condense into one concept the essence of human action, it would be the principle of what he called economizing. And economizing we could state in two different ways because we can economize with respect to the ends and the means. And so we might give these two statements of economizing. With a given means, economizing is aiming at higher valued ends and setting aside, therefore, ends of lesser value. And for a given end that we wish to achieve, economizing would be attaining that end with lower cost means as opposed to higher cost means. Obviously, this is economizing because the additional means that we don't use to acquire one end can be used to acquire another. If I can buy an identical pair of shoes for $80 instead of $100, I have $20 left over to buy something else. And so satisfying more of my ends must always be better than fewer of my ends. And then finally, the last basic principle we want to talk about is imputation, the imputation of value. And let me give you a schematic think about this. And it would look like this, that value begins in the mind. And then it's imputed to consumer goods. I think Dr. Salerno spoke about this, right? So we have value in our mind, the value of the end that we wish to attain. And then we place value on the good as we identify it as being capable of aiding in the attainment of our end. And then the value of the consumer good is imputed to the value of the factors of production. Now you notice that this schematic of imputation follows the logic of ends and means, right? This is just implied by the very fact that action is designed to attain ends. And so it's the value of the end that guides everything else. Value of the end is in our minds, it's subjective. And therefore we value means that we identify as being helpful to attain the end. And if those means, these consumer goods need to be produced, then we value the factors of production in relation to their ability to aid in the production of the consumer goods. I'll give you one brief example of this. My oldest son is now 14 years old, and he has gotten involved in a contact sport called Dagger Here. Doesn't ring a bell with any of you, right? Okay, well, see, he's just cooler than you guys, right? More cutting edge than you guys are. Well, Dagger Here is full body contact medieval battle, and what these guys do is, they dress in, they make their own garb, and they dress in medieval costumes, and then they use padded weapons, swords with dense foam. They're made out of, wrapped in dense foam. And shields and glaives and flails and arrows and javelins and so on and so forth. And then they hold events where they go out and then battle. Right? Hundreds of them come together and they kill each other. And then of course, they're resurrected. And so it's relatively harmless. So my illustration is this, right? So my son likes this. He enjoys the activity. This is the end he's pursuing. He's getting the benefit of engaging in this activity. And therefore, he values the swords. Right? So he's made now five or six of these swords. This is the consumer good, this good that he's using to attain his end. And of course, because he values the consumer good, he's now very interested in buying the foam. And you make these things out of fiberglass poles, like tubing, or PVC pipe. And then you wrap them in the foam. Okay, so the value chain goes that way. He values the end, and then he values the consumer good, and then he values the factors of production. And of course, I get dragged into this and helping him with the production process. But okay, now there is one problem, one other theoretical problem we might note here in thinking about this. What we've set out here is the logic of imputation. We have not yet thought about the chronology of action. We've only thought about its logic. So logically, value begins in the mind, and then is placed on consumer goods, and then is placed on factors of production. But chronologically, that can't be the case, right? Chronologically, there must be something else going on, because chronologically, in order for my son to fight with the sword, he first has to produce it. He has to have it, and to have it, he has to produce it. So chronologically, action must go from the factors of production to the consumer good to the realization of the end, right? And so the question is, how do you reconcile these two? If logic is moving in one direction and the chronology is moving in the other. Well, I should say that any economic theory, at least standard kind of economic treatment of this, would have to face the same question. This question would arise in any way that you try to show a correspondence between these elements of action. The way in which the Austrians do this is through expectations, through speculation. In other words, when my son and I sit down to make a shield, and we start with a piece of, plywood, very thin plywood. Okay, so we go to Lowe's and we buy a piece of plywood. And then the foam that you glue onto it, and so on. What impels us to engage in this action is the anticipation of the value of the end. Using the shield, my son can anticipate using the shield in the battle, which won't happen for another. Well, it won't happen until we get home. A couple weeks. So it's this speculation that we're able to engage in of what the realization of our end will be in the future, that that we use to value the factors of production now. Right? So we still have the logic involved. It's still the value of the end. It's just not the value of the end as it's being realized now. It's the It's a person's anticipation of the realization of the value of the end in the future. So this is the way the Austrians reconcile these two elements. Now, I might just point out, and I think maybe this Professor Salerno mentioned this, but there'd be two other ways logically to think about this relationship. One would be to turn the arrows around. Right? We could turn the arrows around, and we could say maybe the logic goes the other way. Maybe the value of things exists intrinsically in these factors of production. Say the labor theory of value or the cost of production theory of value. You know, I think Dr. Salerno spoke about these alternative theories. And then the argument would have to go this way. So the value is intrinsic in the factors of production, and then through the act of production, it gets embedded in the consumer good. So the prices of the consumer goods are embedded value from the production process. And then somehow our minds have to assent to this value. That would be the last step, right? Our minds have to come to agree that the value of a dagger here sword is $5 or $20, whatever its price would be. So this would be one alternative way of thinking about the relationship. And the other, which is the neoclassical way, is that you have the Marshallian scissors, the dual theory of value, right? That the price of a good, the price of the consumer good, the value, we're speaking about the objective value of the consumer good now, is co-determined by the subjective value in our minds and the intrinsic objective value of the factors of production. So this would be, again, another alternative. Now notice, fundamentally, both of these alternatives must be rejected on the logical grounds that we've already seen, which is that the value of the end is always supreme. In action is designed to attain the end, and the value of the end must rule then the value of all other things. The value of the means, first consumer goods. If the value of the consumer good is determined by the value of the end it attains, and the value of the factors of production, too, can only exist as they aid the production of the consumer good, and therefore are aids to the attainment of the end. Now, again, we'll have more to say about this on Wednesday, but at this point we can see what I would consider the fundamental defect here of these alternatives. Now let's turn our attention to this question of appraisement, and you'll hear a lot more about this during the week, and so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but just to introduce the notion. When we move from the realm of individual action, where we've been up to this point, we're just thinking about your action or my action or my son's action, you know, and the ends means structure of it and how we value things within it. When we move outside of that realm into human interaction, into the social realm, then, as I pointed out before, we have this value problem, if you will. How do we reconcile the different valuations that we have in the social realm? How do we tell whether I value chocolate ice cream more than you value vanilla, when we wish to engage in a division of labor where a third party is producing to satisfy the consumptive ends of me and you, how the third party decides between us? How does he compare the value in my mind of the chocolate ice cream and the value in your mind of vanilla in order to economize the use of the factors of production in the social setting? So this is the problem that appraisement addresses. Now, let's first just see briefly why valuation cannot solve this problem. And let's start with the ends, and then we'll do the means. So again, the problem is, how do we decide what the more valued ends are for the productive factors in the division of labor to be devoted to when these ends exist in the minds of different persons? I have the chocolate ice cream value, you have the vanilla ice cream value. Well, notice no single person can rank all of these different valuations. That would not be an alternative available to us as human beings. This is because in order for a value to be established, as we said before, it must be in action. The value is not just the musings that we have in our minds about what people should want. You should all value chocolate more than vanilla or vice versa. It's the actual a preference that a person has in his mind as he chooses to act one way or another. Now, in order to know that, a person has to experience it. This can only be known by the This is what subjectivity implies, right? It can only be known by me or by you. You have your experience from your own actions. I have my experience from my actions. But no third party can experience both of our actions. No third party has our mind and is able to put in his own mind to put our minds together and weigh one of the valuations in one mind against the other valuation in another mind. So that sort of an option is not available to us. Nor is it possible for us to make objective comparisons between ourselves of the value of, that we have in our minds. Right? This too is, that option is not open to us. We can talk till we're blue in the face about how the value of chocolate is greater to me or the value of vanilla is greater to you, but there's no objective standard we can use on the basis of our valuation. There's no objective existence of anything from valuation itself that we could use to make this comparison. Now, on the means side, we have a similar a dual difficulty, right? Remember, the means, to economize them, we want to use lower-cost means to produce any particular good and hold on to the higher valued means to apply them to something else. So to economize in society, we would have to have a way of choosing. How do we know what is a lower-cost means or what is a higher-cost means? Well, again, we could think through the problem involved in having a single person do this. Why couldn't a single person, the central planner, just decide? Why couldn't he assess the opportunity cost of all the different activities in the division of labor? And again, remember, the fundamental problem here is that he cannot experience these options. The division of labor is made up of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of different activities. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of different factors of production, and the central planner cannot experience the use of all these things, right? He can't. He would be dumbfounded in the face of this problem. So he can't use his own personal valuation to decide. He can only do this with a limited number of things that he himself can experience. So we're left with the alternative, which is we'd have to do this among ourselves, right? You're a baker, I'm a farmer, and so you would have to value your service, your labor services in baking, and I would have to value my labor services in farming and the land that I use and so on and so forth. Well, then we have the interpersonal utility comparison problem. We can never decide whether I should get more factors of production, inputs, or whether you should get these inputs, more labor, land, capital equipment, and so on the basis of our own personal valuation. Now, of course, the way in which this is solved, and again, we're just giving an abbreviated discussion of this now, is through economic calculation. And it's through the market process, where voluntary exchange demonstrates the preferences that people have in a common unit, and that common unit is money. So all of our valuations are expressed for and against money. All of the opportunity costs we have for the factors of production that we own are expressed for and against money. And the monetary results can be compared. They are objective. So the comparison can be made in monetary terms so that the producer can determine whether or not a certain line of production producing chocolate ice cream is in fact profitable in a monetary sense or whether it would incur losses. Now, again, we're not going to pursue appraisement itself. There's special lectures on this later, but I did want to write out the schematic of how these things are related. And this schematic looks as follows. So at the top, we have preferences. This is logically the beginning point. And remember, when I say that preferences are logically the beginning point, I'm not saying that there aren't things that we prefer, that there are conditions of acting and certain elements of the action and means, in other words, that exist in the world that we're preferring. So again, there are things that are sort of chronologically before the preferences. It's just that logically, all of those things have their effect on action through our mind. So unless they affect our preferences, they have no result or effect on action. And the effect that they do have is determined by the judgment of our mind and not by the thing itself. Okay, so we have preferences, and preferences then lead to, on the one side, demand for goods. then on the other side, supply. The supply of goods. And demand and supply then give us prices. Prices of goods. Okay, so this is the first step of logic, right? How do we get the prices of the consumer goods? The prices of the goods then generate revenue. For the entrepreneur. And costs for the consumer. So the entrepreneur earns revenue according to the prices and sales of the goods. Consumers pay their expenses in order to buy the good based upon the prices. And the revenue for the entrepreneurs determines the demand for the factors. The factors of production. So the imputation process, again, is that the value of the consumer goods is what constrains the value of the factors of production, and we value factors in accordance with the value of their productive capacity in making these goods. And then the supply of the factors, again, comes directly from our preferences, right? Our labor and other things that we own. So we're just establishing a preference of these things relative to money. And then supply of the factors and demand give us the prices of the factors, and the prices of the factors generate costs for the entrepreneur and income for the factor owners. Okay, so this is the schematic, and then microeconomics, so to speak, is filling in the gaps here, right? What are the precise theories that give us these relationships, but you can see how appraisement or economic calculation then fits into this. It fits in these two steps, right? So we have revenue from the sale of the good and costs from the hiring or the purchase of the factors of production, and this gives us two forms of economic calculation, net income. By which the entrepreneur makes production decisions, right? Which factors of production should be devoted to which consumer goods. This is based upon whether the consumer goods generate more revenue from consumer demands and cost of production from the opportunity costs of using them somewhere else. And then net worth. So net income is just revenue minus costs for production decisions. Net worth, assets minus liabilities. Net worth is used to make capital investment decisions, right? What new factors of production will be produced as opposed to consumer goods. And again, much will be said about those things later. Now, what we want to turn our attention to with the rest of the time is just this first step, right, to see how the Austrians argue with respect to the connections logically between preferences and the prices of goods. What's their theory of demand and supply? And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about the second step, the prices of the factors of production. Okay, now, the theories of demand and supply are based upon the laws of utility. And these laws of utility are derived from the principles of economizing and imputation. So they just follow directly from prior principles that we've talked about. And then there's one condition that must exist logically for the laws to apply. And this condition is what Rothbard calls equally serviceable units of a good. The laws of utility only apply when they're equally serviceable units of a good. Now, briefly, the unit of the good is the amount of the good. It would involve quality as well, but we'll just think about the amount of the good. Is the amount of a good that a person chooses as appropriate for action. So this is a selected element of acting. The unit of good is not a technological objective fact. It's related to the technological possibilities of the world, of course, but it's not merely that. It's the amount of the good that the person chooses in this action because he believes it is appropriate for the action. Again, to go back to the dagger here swords, if you want to make a dagger here sword, the easiest way to do it, the cheapest way, so sort of the way I do it, is to get camping foam. Ever seen this at Walmart? You can buy these mats of high-density foam, and you put sleeping bags on them. It increases the comfort of camp. I don't camp, but I just found that out through Dagger here. So you buy the camping foam. It's yay thick, about an inch thick. Very high density. When you try to squeeze it, it's very dense, very difficult to compress. And you can buy, it's maybe 3 feet wide, 4 feet wide by 7 feet long, 8 feet long. I'm not sure of the exact dimensions, but you can buy a roll of this for, say, $7, $8 at Walmart. Okay, so you have let's say you want to make a sword, and a sword takes a fourth of a roll of a camping foam. Okay, so that would be the unit that would be necessary in action, right? A person would select, if possible, if it were possible to buy that amount, and you just wanted to make one sword, you would select that amount. If you want to make 8 swords, you'd have to have 2 rolls, right? And so you go into Walmart and you're saying, I want 8 swords or whatever. You'd know that would be the unit then that you select as appropriate for your action. Now, equally serviceable unit is a unit that would be interchangeably useful with other units. So again, the camping foam rolls would be interchangeably useful for swords as well as shields, as well as glaives. Glaives are the long spears with sword blades on the end, and so on. So you could interchangeably use them in different pursuits, or you could use them for camping, or maybe other things as well. So this is the idea, right, of equally serviceable units. You have a self-selected unit that's appropriate, selected by the actor as appropriate for action, and then it's possible to imagine, to conceive of the existence of physically identical units like that, or at least equally serviceable. They wouldn't have to be physically identical, but equally serviceable. So the camp foam, I've only seen it in blue. But if it came in green, it would be equally serviceable. At least to me, it wouldn't make any difference. Okay, so this is the idea, equally serviceable units. Now, to Joe Salerno has already spoken about Boom Bhavorkh's discussion of these principles, right, diminishing marginal utility, and using the cows and the horses. But we're in favor of capitalism. Let's modernize the example a little bit and use automobiles. Okay. So let's say we have a guy who owns a Honda Civic. That's his selected unit of a transportation device, an automobile. And we know the principle of economizing is that of all the ends that he can imagine satisfying with this means, he actually applies the means to the highest valued end. Let's say he uses the Honda Civic to commute. So there he is, and he's using it every day, going back and forth to work. This is his highest valued end. And then we ask this question, if it were possible for him to possess another equally serviceable unit of this good, he could possess another physically identical Honda Civic, and the thing was still scarce, it was still a good, and thus it was still scarce to him. Obviously, economizing would mean he would have to apply it now to a less valued end. Since one unit is satisfying his highest valued end, the second unit would necessarily be applied to a less valued end. and so we get from this notion the first law of utility, as Rothbard puts it. Since this individual will impute value to the means according to the value of the end satisfied, if he only has one Honda Civic, he would impute the value of commuting to it, the value that it aids in the process of commuting. If he had 2 Honda Civics, he would impute then a lesser value to any one of the Honda Civics, right? He would impute only the value of the second most valuable end to him. And so we get this principle, the first law of utility, diminishing marginal utility. The larger the stock of a good, the lower the utility of the marginal unit. And then, as Rothbard points out, the second law of utility is the principle that a larger stock of a good is always preferred to a smaller stock of a good. Because a larger stock of a good can satisfy more ends than a smaller stock of a good. Remember, it is possible in action to imagine a situation where a good no longer becomes scarce, in which case the laws don't apply, or a situation where a person would like more of a good, but not an equally serviceable unit of a good. And so, okay, so the laws don't apply there, right? The laws only apply when we're considering a situation of equal serviceability. Okay, now from this, of course, we can go directly to the laws of supply and demand. We'll bypass all the intermediate, there's a lot of intermediate principles about exchange and money and so on and so forth. So we'll talk about all those during the week, and we won't be deterred by them here. We'll just assume that you're cognizant of all these things and move right to the application of the principle. And let's just think about someone who might be in the market. Let's call this person buyer A. For a Honda Civic, he doesn't own one yet. And let's say that he establishes a preference. Let's say this is a two-year-old Honda Civic, and he establishes a preference this way. $16,000, he would say, is too much money. If the price of the Honda Civic were $16,000, he'd prefer to keep his money as opposed to acquiring the Honda Civic. But if the price happened to be $15,000, well, then he would prefer the Civic to $15,000. Okay, so this is the establishment of his preference. Remember, we're sort of abstracting from the existence of this preference being in an action. So this preference only really exists when he's actually confronted with an offer and he's deciding, you know, what should I do, buy the Honda Civic or not. Now, notice again, this ranking conforms to the, so far, to the first law of utility. The larger stock of money is ranked above the smaller. Okay. This must be the case, as long as money is a good. And if we extended this down, this, of course, is just a conjecture. This is just an abstraction. This wouldn't be part of this person's actual preference. But we could logically, of course, abstract it down to something like this. Let's say we could imagine that at some price low enough, he'd also buy a second Civic. Let's say if the price were $10,000. Now, again, this part of the preference rank isn't actually part of his preferences. That's just an abstraction of the economist. But we know from the first law of utility, that if a second Honda Civic were ranked on this person's preference scale, it would have to be at a lower price. Now, whether it actually existed would depend upon how he acted. If he could find a place where there are two Civics being offered at $10,000, if he actually bought two, well, okay, that would be his preference then. But we know that the second Honda Civic can't rank above the first, and therefore it can't rank above a sum of money greater than that sum that's ranked just below the first Honda Civic. So this gives us then the law of demand, right? The law of demand just follows directly from this exercise. We could state the law of demand this way, that if the price of a good would have been lower, then the quantity purchased would have either been larger or remained the same. Remember, the law of demand is just a conjecture or an abstraction. It's a claim about what would have happened had conditions of the market been different. But the conditions of the market weren't different, right? They were whatever they were. Let's say the price of the Civic turns out to be $15,000, so this guy would buy one. The law of demand would say, well, if the price would have been lower, this guy would have bought one Honda Civic, or maybe two. If the price would have been $14,000, he would have bought one. If it would have been $13,000, he would have bought one, right? And so on. And at some price low enough, well, maybe he would have bought two. This is the law of demand. So notice the law of demand is not an empirical claim. It's not a claim that, on Tuesday when this guy goes in to buy a Honda Civic, the price is $15,000 and he buys one. And then next Thursday when the price goes down to $10,000, he buys a second one. It doesn't say that at all. It makes no claim that could be empirically testable between two purchases. It's a conjecture about what happens each time anybody buys something. Every time we buy something, then the law of demand says that if the price would have been lower, we would have bought the same amount or more. Okay, now, in order to proceed, though, with the demonstration that we wanted, right, how the price of the good is determined by the preferences. We also need to add other buyers to this market. We need to have competition, competitive bidding among the buyers. And let's say we have a buyer B whose preference rank looks like this. And buyer C, whose preference rank looks like this. And you'll notice that the key condition of these preference ranks is that they differ. They're not uniform or identical. This, of course, just conforms to the principle that in a voluntary exchange, there must always be a difference of value, so that when people come into the market, right, their value differences and preferences differ. And this is what leads open the possibility of exchange and competitive bidding. People's preferences could differ. So we have something like a more eager buyer in buyer A, or sometimes this is called the super marginal buyer, and a less eager buyer, buyer B, the least eager buyer, buyer C, the one who's willing to pay the least amount of money to acquire the good. Okay, then let's say on the supply side of this market, and remember we're working with a situation here, we're presupposing or set up the situation where this Honda Civic is used, so we can eliminate any difficulties of thinking about production costs. That again comes later in the logic. We're just thinking about a used car, so consumer wanting to buy a car from another consumer who bought it in the past. Right? It's not that the buyers are buying from Honda. That would complicate. It wouldn't change our analysis, but it would complicate it somewhat. So let's say we have sellers and this side of the market. Let's say seller X, and let's say seller X has a preference rank that looks like this. And let's say that he, for some reason, happens to own two Honda Civics. And his preference rank looks like that. Let's say he owned a Honda Civic and his uncle passed away and willed him a second one. And so he just wound up with it without intention, right? Without sort of seeking out the acquisition of it. And he winds up with it. So he thinks, okay, well, look, there's not much valuable use personally that I can put this to. I'd certainly be willing just to sell it for a lower price because the preference I place upon it, the value I place on its opportunity cost is not very great. But the first one he finds very valuable. He's using it, again, like buyer A would for a very valuable use. And then let's say if we just, again, think about the logic of supply here. So if the price we see were 11,000, again, let's suppose that he's facing an actual market situation where he can trade. If the price were 11,000, yes, he would sell. He would sell that second Honda Civic, right? Since they're equally serviceable, they're not distinguishable by their technical features, but he would sell the second most valued use of the Honda Civic, lending it out to his friends or whatever the second most valued use was. So he would sell that unit, but not the first at that price, right? He'd hold on to the first Honda Civic, the one he's applying to the higher valued uses. So at lower prices, there would be a small quantity sold, and then we see, of course, that only if the price were higher would the quantity sold have been greater. So we can state the law of supply that in that way that if the price of the good would have been higher, the quantity sold would have been either larger or the same. So this again is a direct implication of the laws of utility. And then let's also have a competition on the seller side. Well, let's have seller Y, who's less eager than seller X to sell his first, his only Honda Civic, and then make seller Z the least eager of them. Say he only sells at the price is 15. or above. Okay, now again, this example, of course, is only designed to illustrate the principles of actual markets, right? We're not saying that somehow these existing options are part of people's mental apparatus and so on as they trade. We're just saying this. We're saying, if you look at the market, if you investigate what a two-year-old Honda Civic sells for of a certain model and so on, well, you see a price. You see a price for it. So right now it's selling at some particular price, let's say $13,000. And the question we're trying to pursue is, why is it $13,000? Why isn't the price higher than that or lower than that? Why is it 13 and not something else? So why is the price of a gallon of milk $3, the price of a gallon of gas $2.79, and so on? That's the question. It's this particular feature of markets that we're trying to explain. Right? The apparatus is just an aid to this. And this, of course, is the idea that Austrians call the market clearing price. So let's say we have, in our example, these different prices, different quantities sold, and sold and bought, and so the sold is 3. So right, all the sellers want to sell at that particular price, and then only 2 at 14, 2 at 13, and then 1 and 1. And then on the buyer's side, it's 1, 1, 2, 2, and 3. And so the market clearing price is this price, basically, where the market clears. Quantity supplied and quantity demand are the same. And so the Austrian claim is that this is the actual price of the good. The actual price of the good is at the level that clears the market. Now, why is this so? In other words, why can't the price be above or below this level? Why does it conform to the point at which the market clears? Well, the first reason to see this, a basic reason, is that it's this market clearing price at which all the preferences of all the buyers and the sellers are satisfied. Action, of course, is always designed to attain ends. It's designed to bring about the preferable state of affairs. And if the market clears, then everyone is at that point satisfied with the outcome. Everyone is obtaining the preferred state of affairs. If the market does not clear, then there's some people who don't attain their preferred state of affairs. And therefore, they try to avoid this situation, right? They try to avoid either excess supply or excess demand, some of the participants, because this frustrates the endeavor that they're engaged in to satisfy their ends, to attain what they prefer and give up what they prefer less. So this is the basic reason why the market clears. Now, let's just think quickly about these two alternatives, right? A price above and a price below. Let's say the market price of $15,000. And so there, of course, there would be excess supply in the market. There would be more sellers that want to sell than buyers that want to buy. And obviously, for some of the sellers that aren't able to sell, this is not preferable. They don't prefer to ask a price and then have no sale at all. But they're in the market to sell, if their preferences are such, at some price. In other words, they're willing to sell at a lower price, and if they ask a price too high, they won't sell. But if they ask a price lower, which they're willing to accept, then they will sell. Well, of course, that's what they'll do then, right? They'll try to avoid excess supply. So the sellers will even anticipate this, right? So it isn't just that the market is something like a trial and error process where people try things out and then, we had excess supply last night, and so we better lower our price today or something. That isn't how it works. What people do is attempt to anticipate what the demand will actually be as they set the price now. Right? Will demand support this price if I'm a seller? Will I be able to fetch this price and so on? So it's a speculative. There's a speculative element to all prices. And it's a speculative element that tends to bring about the clearing of markets. The same, of course, is true on the low end, right? Where the buyers, you know, a buyer might be in, he might think, well, you know, I'll try to get a real low price. I'll try to, you know, offer a real low price to the sellers, and maybe just I'll get lucky and be able to buy the Honda Civic at that price. But again, the reason that buyers don't actually do this is because they can anticipate the result. I mean, if I were in the market for a two-year-old Honda Civic, I could anticipate the result of me offering to buy a Honda Civic from someone who owned it of, you know, an absurdly low price. I already know in advance what will happen. They won't sell to me because there is another buyer they can sell to at that price, or at least a higher price than I'm offering. And so if I'm willing to pay a higher price, if my preferences are such, you know, like a buyer A, where I'm willing to pay the higher price to get the good, that's what I will do. I will outcompete those who would undercut me, you know, and try to obtain the good at a lower price. And then the market would clear. And so, once again, it's the speculative anticipation of the buyers that has a tendency to avoid errors. It's not that errors aren't made in markets or in action in general. It's just that we wish to avoid them. And if we wish to avoid them, then we have incentive to anticipate the outcome of our actions. What will happen if we offer this amount or ask this amount of money in exchange? Now, let me just conclude and leave it up to the moderators whether we have any time for questions, but by reiterating two points here, just to kind of make a bigger distinction between the Austrian treatment of these points and the standard treatment. For these, what we've arrived at is something like a theory of existing prices. In other words, the Austrian view of price theory is that the theory is explaining the actual prices of existing goods in markets right now. The price of bread in the grocery store, the price of gas at the gas station, the price of cars at the auto dealer. It's those prices that are being explained by this theory. Those are the market clearing prices. These prices are not hypothetical. Austrian theory doesn't try to explain hypothetical price. What would prices be in long-run equilibrium? That's not what this theory is telling us. And the reason for that, the reason that Austrians focus on real, actual prices is, of course, it's these prices that are relevant for appraisement, for economic calculation. It's these prices that the entrepreneurs are using for economic calculation. It's the actual prices of the market that they are seeing and trading in and buying and selling in that they make their own speculative anticipations about with regards to their own action. Should I produce this good given the array of prices that exist for factors and the array of prices that exist for the consumer goods? What possibilities exist for profit if I buy these factors and produce goods and then sell them in the future? And so this is the, you know, the realism of the price theory that you would not find in a standard treatment. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.